This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look back to discuss the broader meaning of the recent transit strike.
The New York City transit strike got a bad rap in a lot of the papers in New York. But there's another side to the story. They stood up for what was right and for the future of workers.
We'll also meet with one of the representatives from the Hurricane Student Network.
Where was our federal government? Why did it take volunteer students from all over the country to give help to the people of New Orleans?
And we'll hear clips from this weekend's War Crimes Tribunal.
This administration is criminal, and this War Crimes Tribunal proved it.
We'll talk with our own Michael Ratner about a recently filed lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights against the National Security Agency.
This administration is off the charts in terms of its illegality. It throws legal sand in our faces, claiming the right to wiretap people. The president, whatever he says, goes. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
In response to recent revelations of unlawful electronic surveillance by the government, last week the Center for Constitutional Rights broke ground in filing a lawsuit against the NSA. The lawsuit alleges that several attorneys, especially ones working on Guantanamo cases at the center, are likely the subject of such unlawful surveillance. Today we'll be talking with our own Michael Ratner about the repercussions of the surveillance and what this means for attorneys and their communications with clients, which are held to be confidential.
The lawsuit, as people probably recall, stems out of revelations that took place about 6 weeks ago, where it was reported that the government, through the National Security Agency, was avoiding any requirements of getting a warrant under the Special Warrant Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court or under the regular courts, and was wiretapping hundreds, possibly thousands of American citizens on their communications with people overseas. The criteria they set for those was that people in the United States who communicated with alleged terrorists, people involved in al-Qaeda, indirectly or directly, could be subject to the tap. And of course, one of the reasons the center went forward here is if there's any organization now in this country that communicates worldwide with our clients, many of whom are alleged to be al-Qaeda or alleged terrorists, it's lawyers at the center. The feeling is very strong at the center that we have been one of the prime subjects of the wiretap and that they did not go to the special court because they could not ever get a warrant to wiretap attorneys.
Yeah, but Michael, you ought to add to that that the center has many, many cooperating attorneys around the country, and a lot of these people are Republicans in the best sense of the word. They don't share our politics, but they certainly share our notions of supporting democracy. And these men and women are from these top firms, and I suspect that the discovery in this lawsuit is going to show that they were tapped too. And that's why the Bush administration didn't want to go to the FISA court, because it didn't want to have to explain that they were going to tap the phones
and
of some of the major
likely would have
in the
been
country.
Denied the FISA warrants.
They might have been.
The Guild is pleased to also be cooperating with this lawsuit. We have, as you know, a long history of defending those who have been the objects of unlawful government surveillance, and we're very pleased to be able to have Michael Avery be one of the attorneys listed on this lawsuit. When you heard about the spying, what did the attorneys at the center do, if anything, in changing the way they communicated with their clients?
Well, obviously, once we heard this was going on, we were pretty sure that we were the targets of it, and or at least one of the targets of it. And at that point, you become much more careful. I mean, I'm not going to tell you exactly what we've done for everything, but one of the things you have to do is you have to pull your horns in. You can't just have communications over phone or email that you would have had before. So, for example, we now have a lawyer who had a flight to the Middle East as a way of working with the families of our clients. That's our main communication, of course, is with the families of the people at Guantanamo. And so that lawyer is now in the Middle East meeting with families, we hope in a private way, because we can't communicate by telephone or by email with people. So it has caused us, you know, actually to take a number of actions to try and avoid the government intruding on our attorney-client conversations.
And what about past communications, as you mentioned, both email and telephone, any written correspondence as well? Have you done anything looking retroactively at communications?
That's what we're undergoing now over the next few months. We're going to see, well, next few weeks, I hope, we're going to really monitor and look at what's going on before and what has probably fallen into the hands of the government. I think one thing we want to talk about is the government's defense to this. This last week in January, the government put out a 42-page paper trying to justify legally what they have done. And it's extraordinary. I mean, we can talk about some of the details, but what it boils down to is the president can do whatever he wants as commander-in-chief in the so-called war on terror. In the name of national security. He can wiretap, just as he said before, he could torture. But it also means he can commit genocide. He can do whatever it wants in the so-called
war on
terror.
And he's saying the Patriot Act, in effect, has a blanket sort of permission to do this.
Well, he's lying. Yeah. I'm not lying, but he's throwing sand in our face about the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is very specific. In fact, it even says you can only wiretap without a warrant for a period of 15 days after a war begins, assuming we're in a war right now, and then you have to go to the special surveillance court. So they actually wrote it in. What you have is a situation here is where the president actually, after 9/11, went to Congress and said, I need more authority to wiretap. They gave it to him in the Patriot Act. And then despite that, he says, the Patriot Act isn't good enough for me. I have the inherent right as the president and commander-in-chief to wiretap whomever I want, wherever I want in the United States.
See, that's what I think is so scary. And the listeners to Law and Disorder will remember this has been the central constant theme of our show since we went on the air a year and a half ago. We said there comes a point when there's no return. You put salt on French fries and they taste pretty good, but eventually you put too much salt on and you're never going to eat those French fries. And I think that's the problem, that we're getting to that point of no return. Al Gore, of all people, Al Gore, who didn't even have the fortitude to protest the election in Florida when they stole it from him. But Al Gore stood up to his everlasting credit and to our gratitude. He stood up in Philadelphia on Martin Luther King Day on January 16th and gave a magnificent speech. It'll be on our website, lawanddisorder.org, and we encourage people to read it. It's a 10-page speech. And Gore said what we've been saying all along. I remember when Michael and I were working on the Counselor book, The Emerging Police State. We weren't sure we were going to call it that because it sounded kind of shrill.
No, in my first article after 9/11, within six weeks, it was called Moving Toward a Police State or Have We Arrived? And I almost thought it was too shrill, that it was too dramatic, it was too out there. And now, I mean, now when people like Gore, as you're going to talk about, go to that place, you see that. And the NSA spying, to bring us back to that for a moment, the NSA spying is one of the key features of the Gore speech. He says the president is acting against and beyond the law, and that is very serious. We're slipping essentially into tyranny.
Yeah, what he says was that that power that the president is unilaterally asserting could mean that Bush and the people around Bush will consolidate power permanently, that there's going to be no going back. Gore says the Congress is paralyzed, that at any one election you get about 12 people who really are facing election, and the rest of them have sure things as seats. He says the media is totally compliant, that you get 5-second sound bites on TV and it doesn't educate anybody. And he says we are at a point now that it may be a point of no return. And Gore doesn't speak for himself. Gore didn't go down to Philadelphia on his own and decide to give this speech. Gore speaks for a significant section of the people that hold power in this country, what Noam Chomsky called the elites. He speaks for a significant sector of them. And, of course, on the other side, you have Bush and his people. Who are they? You know, Enron, Halliburton, what Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex.
But, Michael, didn't you read in the Times last week that I believe there was a poll that said, despite the constitutional ramifications, 51% of people in this country still think that this kind of activity, illegal spying, is warranted in the name of protecting our national security interests.
You know, I get that on the radio all the time. When I get a caller, a guy called in on a show I was on the other day from Texas. He says, look, what they've done to the Fourth Amendment is terrible. They search my car. They stop me. But what the heck? You guys, when you're talking to alleged terrorists overseas, they shouldn't be able to wiretap you. And he says, of course they should be able to. So that is the fear factor here in this country is still at rule in terms of constitutional rights, unfortunately. I think that's right, Heidi.
But I think, though, that first of all, I have to take a look at the poll and make sure that that's a legit poll. And I'd be real suspicious of the poll to start with.
No, we're only polling on the West Coast and East Coast now. We're forgetting about Texas.
Yeah. But secondly, even if it's not 51%, even if it's 43% or 28%, that's bad. That's significant. That means that people in this country are so manipulated that they don't understand what's in their own best interests.
So let me say a word about this, what Gore's speech was. So he talks about the NSA and how they basically this is completely unlawful. And then he talks about everything that we've been talking about on this show, illegal detention at Guantanamo, torture, the illegal trials, and looks at all of these issues and saying, this president is essentially ruling by fiat, is essentially tyranny. And then what he does is, I think we've talked about it once before, how when the president signed the McCain Amendment, the amendment that prohibits torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment.
He wrote that memo.
The signing statement, it's called,
Heidi.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what that does is extraordinary. What the signing statement does is something that really, in my view, is unheard of in America. Because what it does is it says, I, despite this prohibition, I have the right to torture in the name of national security. And the courts are limited. They cannot stop me because I am the president, commander-in-chief at time of war. That is a statement of tyranny. Gore picks it up and he quotes from Madison, Jefferson and Madison, really, but Madison saying when a president or anybody doesn't look at what the legislature, doesn't obey the legislature, and doesn't obey the courts, that's the definition of tyranny. And that's what Gore says. So for us to sit on this program as progressives and say we are living under tyranny, we basically have Gore in our corner.
Yeah. You know, welcome aboard. Although I'm not sure that our solution is the same as Gore's. If you read towards the bottom of Gore's speech, there really isn't much of it. He hand rings and he's worried and so on. But
Did he make proposals for action?
Well, what's he going to say? Vote for another Democrat? You know, you got really one party with two right wings. And he says that these people are in power permanently. You're not going to change them. My solution to what all of us perceive as the problem, and that's the problem of an executive with unparalleled, unchecked power. That's the definition of a police state. Our solution is a different one. And our solution is to educate and agitate and organize and build the movement and eventually build our own party.
Now, what about impeachment of the president?
Well, I think that's coming up more now. In fact,
people are talking about it.
Conyers issued a 500-page report on why the president ought to be impeached. This was before the NSA stuff. This was on Iraq primarily and the illegal war. He doesn't actually call for impeachment, and he says the reason he doesn't is that in Congress right now he couldn't get such a resolution through. So, but he says this is impeachable, but what he wants is an independent inquiry into looking into these crimes of the administration.
Yeah.
So Conyers has issued a report, which I just recommend to everybody. We'll try and put a link up on our site.
Great.
500 pages. He has been a leader on this, but a lot of these guys are afraid of it. They're afraid of the I word.
The second to last president to be impeached, Nixon, his lawyer, John Dean, wrote a book where he it's an 11-chapter book, and he gives 11 different reasons why Bush should be impeached. And this was before all the torture stuff came out and before the spine came out. And Dean, who's an intelligent guy, and you know, who, like a lot of other people, like, say, Paul O'Neill, Bush's Secretary of the Treasury, who was forced out. I mean, there's a whole shelf of books in the bookstores of people who've defected from this administration, from the State Department, from the military, you know, who see what's going on and don't like it. And they don't like it because they understand something about American democracy, and they see that it's really hanging in the balance.
You know, when King gave his speech that we referred to, the April 1967 speech at Riverside against the war, he ended the speech saying, "It's time to act." And he said, "Sometimes you can wait too long, and then it's irrevocable. There's no time left." He had this quote in there about, "Don't wait until tomorrow. Tomorrow is today." And then he basically said, "It's time to act." And that's right. And that's right right now. And so the things that you're suggesting, Michael, which are really not just speaking and talking, but really massive protest, massive civil disobedience, massive disobeying, really is what we're really talking about right now. Mm-hmm. The question for all of us is, how do we get a country, even where many of the college students are asleep, to actually go into the streets?
Well, I know that many people that might not have listened before did listen to Gore last week. I mean, he is reaching a segment that people who are maybe lulled into a certain complacency, but when they hear him speaking after his long silence and inactivity, it might help.
And from his position as a Washington insider ever since he was a little kid, I mean, after all, his father was one of the leaders of the Senate in Washington, Senator Al Gore. He was a congressman, he was a senator, he was the vice president, he presided over the Senate. This is a guy that goes back 60 years in Washington. He knows what he's talking about. And if Gore says we're on the verge of irreversible authoritarian situation here, you know, that's not to be taken lightly.
So the question really for all of us, for all our listeners, is getting active and what to do. And I can guarantee you this, it's not going down to Washington and lobbying a bunch of Democratic senators and Democratic congressmen who have basically sold us out, kicked us in the teeth, and are part of the establishment. So it's hitting the streets, it's disobedience, it's mass protest, and it's saying to this government, no, there's a better world ahead.
Good morning. This is Jeff Brady, producer of Law and Disorder. We want to update listeners on this topic. New York City transit workers refused to ratify the contract that their leadership negotiated for them after the three-day pre-Christmas strike. In this next interview, the Law and Disorder hosts speak with labor attorney Richard Levy and transit worker Marty Goodman. This interview gives some indication of why the contract was rejected.
Real happy to have two guests on our show to talk about the transit strike. We've got Richard Levy, who is a labor lawyer here in New York City, represents the Hospital Workers Union, actually, attorney Richard Levy. And we also have Marty Goodman, who's a transit worker. He's a member of the executive board of Local 100. He's been working in the transit union since 1986. He's a station agent. Marty was active in the strike. Richard has been following it. Richard knows the legal angle with respect to the Taylor law. Marty knows what happened down in the union. So we're very pleased to have both Marty and Richard here on the show. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marty, let me start off with you. I wanted to get your take on what you think was at stake at the strike, what you think was gained and lost, and where you go from here. And then, Richard, I'd like your impression on it and what you think of the Taylor law, where it came from and what they use it for. But, Marty, first, you know, give me your take on the strike.
Well, the strike, which began on the 20th, was delayed a bit. I believe it should have begun on at 12:01 on December 16th, the moment after the expiration of the contract. I was for going out at that time. The stakes in the strike are very high. Labor across the country, as well as management, were watching carefully what we did. We drew a line in the sand on the issue of dividing our union in regard to new hires paying a higher premium for their pensions, which was, with the final offer, you know, the same retirement age. However, new members would pay 6% of their wages into the pension fund to maintain it. President Calico of the MTA arrived at negotiations at 11 p.m. the evening that the contract was to expire at midnight. A highly insulting statement in and of itself. They were adamant. They have over $1 billion surplus, and yet they were their primary objective was to extract givebacks from transit workers. We had quite enough of it. In 2002, we had a first year zero and 3% and 3% wage increases, which by no means kept up with inflation.
Richard, can you actually get amnesty from the?
I'm very dubious that that's a possibility, and certainly doubtful that it's one that could have been granted by the MTA.
And what is the Taylor Law anyway?
Well, the Taylor Law is a law that forbids strikes by public employees. It's a pretty draconian measure and limits many categories of public workers. Historically, there was an analogous law that affected hospital workers in the union that I now represent. It was illegal for them to strike. Just by way of background, in the 60s, they challenged that law. Their leadership went to jail, and ultimately the state did back down, but it did so legislatively. I'm doubtful in this situation whether MTA could have waived those provisions of statute, because the statute is pretty clear on its face.
But I guess they could have encouraged whoever goes to court against the union not to ask that. What happens? They go to jail? When you say amnesty, you and Marty, what does it really mean?
Well, there are ways around it. For example, the teacher strike back in 68, right after the Taylor Law was voted on and voted into law in 67, I think the best way to defeat the Taylor Law is simply to strike and just bust the damn law wide open. That's the best.
That's a theory. I think.
Well, obviously, we haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
So, we're a powerhouse union, and the labor movement around the country was watching us as we said no to givebacks, drew a line in the sand against dividing our membership, and we scared the hell out of the powers that be.
Yeah,
Marty, the country.
Can I suggest something? This is Richard Levy. I think he had a tremendous victory here, and it's troublesome that the victory itself is not being seized. I really agree with your first comment, which was that labor across the country was watching this.
Yes.
And I want to first of all salute you and everybody else in this union for demonstrating absolutely incredible courage and being such a model for workers everywhere that you can stand up and fight. So without quibbling with you over how long that fight should have gone or whether or not you really could have gotten amnesty at the end, which from a legal standpoint I think is difficult, but I think there could have been maybe some amelioration. I want to stress the importance of what you did, and if I could take a minute, I'd like to put it in a little context.
Yeah, please do.
Speak to that issue also.
Yeah.
We have Richard Levy, New York City labor law attorney, and Marty Goodman from the Transit Workers Union. Richard, what was your take on it?
I just want to say that, to me, this was like one of the first really major stand-ups against a trend in this country that's pretty horrifying when you really stop and think about it, and that is the loss of pensions and health coverage as well, for millions and millions of Americans. In 1978, there were 128,000 defined benefit pension plans, like the MTA transit plan, in this country. Today, there are 26,000, less than a fifth of the defined pension plans that existed 25 years ago. The IBM freeze will knock 117,000 workers off their defined plan. And keep in mind that IBM is following Motorola, Verizon, Hewlett-Packard, Sears, and thousands of other companies that have cut back these plans. So when transit in this city went out on strike and said, we will not take it, I think the salute here and the applause should be deafening. And I think it should come from all workers in New York, many of whom, sadly, I think, didn't understand how much the transit fight was really a fight for them. And by the way, I have to say, Marty, that if you didn't win anything, everything, I should say, I think you won. I think the city looks like crap. Calico comes out and says, I screwed up in my proposals. I caused a strike in this city over $20 million bucks over 3 years, $7 million a year, chump change, less money than was spent on the cops, overtime pay for cops to work the strike. What kind of business decision is that? What kind of sense is that? You guys have made this city leadership look absolutely foolish. You know, you've stood up. You've gotten a tremendous victory for workers everywhere. And I just think that that context is incredibly important. And I hope whatever comes out of your various votes, that the victory here isn't lost or lost sight of, Marty, because you guys did a great job.
Marty, I wanted to ask you one thing. What was the level of organization within the union? I was kind of disappointed that the union itself wasn't out there so publicly getting out the word to people so they would understand. Richard was saying earlier
that subway stops.
You know, people can understand the civil liberties issue, the democratic rights issue, but why don't people understand the union issue? And secondly, what kind of support did you get from other unions in the city?
The Taxi Workers Alliance, which has a lot of immigrant workers, by the way, at least 30% or more of the cabbies refused to pick up passengers. They made a statement about this. It enraged the city. It enraged Giuliani when they did the same thing back in 99.
You know, Marty, this is Richard. I just want to say that you guys did get support. You got some verbal support, and I saw some of it on TV. But I don't think you got as much support as you deserved.
Not at all.
I think, and I'm a union lawyer. I represent a bunch of unions, and I hope I don't lose clients over this. Yep. But I think that the unions should have been clearer to their memberships and to the city as a whole how important your strike was for everyone. Well, I want to just say one other thing, Marty, about the PR. If I had one criticism of what went down here, it would be over the public relations campaign.
Yeah.
I think it was really too weak. And I don't think people understood. I don't think it was hammered home. When you're talking about a 55-year pension, you're talking about 55 years with 25 years of service, 25 years of riding around underground in a 4x4 subway cab in the grit and the dirt and the lack of air and sunlight. How many more years after 55 are you supposed to work under those conditions?
Well, how many more years do you have?
Yeah, and was that made? And Marty, that kind of stuff wasn't made clear enough. It wasn't made clear, and I think that was a problem.
There were reasons for that. Number one, I don't believe the union was properly prepared. On the executive board, I called for extra mass meetings of the membership a year and a half before the contract expiration, many times, to prepare the membership mentally and organizationally for this upcoming epical battle that we went through.
We've only got a short time left. I wanted to ask Richard and then you, Marty, for your last thoughts on the transit worker strike. Richard, you first.
Well, I want to say, apart from that I think it's a tremendous victory, I want to add one other point of context here, and that is you're looking at cuts against public workers that were attempted here by the state and to some extent obtained. But what's really the issue here? The issue here is that this society and this government in particular is not prepared to pay for the services that people need and to have workers properly compensated for their work and benefits provided. And why? Because we have a totally regressive tax policy. And I don't want to broaden this discussion too much, but, you know, taxes in this country for the highest level people have fallen from about 94% in 1945 to about 35% today. So we don't want to tax the rich. And because we can't tax the rich, we fight the working people over their pensions, and we fight them over health care, and we fight them over their salaries because we are unwilling to tax the rich. And we'll give a $27 billion tax cut to the rich starting 1/1/06. Rather than provide pensions for working people. It's
Thank
a
you,
very
Richard Levy.
Policy.
And Marty, your last thoughts on it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a wholesale attack and offensive against working people's health plans. The profits are astronomical. Wholesale attack on pensions. Absolutely what Mr. Levy said was correct. And we held the line on the pension issue, dividing our membership. Quite true.
Thank you very much, Marty Goodman, Richard Levy. You've got our solidarity here at Law and Disorder, and thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
You.
Students around the country are playing an active role in helping deal with the staggering aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Many of them have formed the Law Student Hurricane Relief Network to bring resources of their school communities to bear on the long-term legal aid and disaster relief effort. The network links students with pro bono opportunities with legal aid agencies in the affected areas, identifies research possibilities, and also provides support to volunteer initiatives so students can work with them from their schools. Joining us today is Vanessa Spinozola, who happens to be a National Lawyers Guild member and who has been active in the network. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Vanessa, tell us a bit about how you became involved in this initiative.
Well, I myself am a displaced student from Loyola, New Orleans, and I'm up at New York at Fordham this semester. And a bunch of the students here and at Columbia Law School just started organizing what they call caravans to go down. So I just started kind of helping them organize. We started working with all the New York law schools, and then there were some other efforts going along at the same time. And it just kind of grew and grew until it came kind of a national thing. And just kind of there was so much work that whoever was willing to kind of step up and help out pretty much got to help out. So I did that.
And are you getting a good response from students, say, in the West Coast and around the country as well?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, we have students literally from everywhere, except for maybe Alaska and Hawaii. But yeah, I mean, students from like Willamette, UCLA, University of Montana, UConn, schools all over the South, Texas. Really everywhere, students from everywhere have been willing to go spend their own money to go down to the coast over the break.
Are law schools providing any financial support in this effort?
Some schools have. Some of the schools that had a little bit more notice, like Columbia and Fordham and UConn, are providing their students with money. Where there's some larger groups of students going, a lot of students are just kind of either going by themselves or in small groups. So for spring break, we're definitely going to have a more organized fundraising, I guess you could call it, effort to try and get some of the schools, you know, with sufficient notice to help their students go down to the area.
And when the students go down in these caravans, what happens when they get down there?
Well, this is a trial run, but what they'll do, we've organized housing for them. Churches and gyms and museums are helping us put people up. And they're basically working with a number of different organizations. We're working with people like the ACLU and the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and the Advancement Project and Juvenile Justice Project. There's a whole list of organizations. Students will be doing many different things. In some cases, they'll be going out in the areas, speaking with, for example, workers at the labor camps, some of the immigrant workers, trying to document information. They may be helping agencies, overwhelmed legal agencies, just kind of clean up their files from before this mess and trying to track down clients that are now dispersed all throughout the country. Really whatever the legal organizations think that they need and that they see that the community needs.
And so those organizations have been supportive of this student network?
Oh, definitely. They are so excited to have people come down. And I think that students have wanted to help. And part of the goal of the Student Hurricane Network was to kind of streamline it so there weren't all sorts of random students calling these organizations. They just have, you know, a few contact people, and we can address their needs quickly and provide them with lots of bodies to get the work done.
Did other fellow students of yours come up to New York as well?
Yeah, there are. Actually, at Fordham, there's five or six other students from Loyola, and there's about 20 students from Tulane, and I know there's other students in New York as well.
And are any of you receiving academic credit for this fabulous work that you're doing?
That's yet to be seen. I'm actually personally working with Professor Bill Quigley out of Loyola. But we'll
yes.
see. And then some other
Great.
Students at different schools are getting some of their pro bono hours and stuff done through the work that they're doing. So hopefully for spring we'll have some more time to kind of organize that and help people get that done. And then the research aspect that you mentioned before, I think a lot of students had to write papers for their finals, so we've been able to offer some kind of research opportunities that are Katrina-focused that they can in turn write for their papers for their finals. So that was a good way to link up.
Vanessa, this is Michael Ratner speaking. Are you in New Orleans, or are you also going into the Mississippi Gulf?
We are. We are going into Mississippi as well. We're working with a Mississippi Immigrant Rights Project Alliance there and a couple other Mississippi organizations. The stronger right now is New Orleans just because you know, we focused on them first. We got responses from them first. But we're definitely, you know, the whole Gulf Coast for spring, hopefully, you know, expand even into Houston. And eventually we're going to advocate for students to help evacuees, you know, everywhere in the country where they are.
I have a question about some of the bigger legal issues that I've been reading about and don't really know that much about. One is, of course, FEMA and people's applications for help from FEMA, whether you guys are involved in that, what you know about that. A second one is, of course, the refusal of the insurance companies to pay people for flood insurance because they claim the houses were blown down and not flooded, or the people didn't have flood insurance because of federal government's lack of doing that. The third one we read about today in the paper having to do with failure to give business loans to people whose houses have been destroyed. Is that the kind of work you guys are going to doing, or are you looking at those issues?
Well, first in regards to FEMA, I know the Loyola Law School Clinic, they've been located in Houston, has basically been stationed at a FEMA Disaster Relief Center, so they've been assisting with that. And I know that some of the students that will be working with NOLAC, New Orleans Legal Assistance Center, will be helping people with actually everything that you mentioned, all their kind of government benefit claims, you know, the small benefits claims, the FEMA claims, that type of thing.
Right.
The organizations that we happen to hook up with this time around, I don't know off the top of my hand if they're working with any insurance issues. We are working with Acorn, and I know they're trying to help people trace their titles back. But I'm not sure any of them have yet got to the insurance issues.
And you're heading down with the caravan soon?
Yes.
And how long will you be down there?
I'm going back.
Oh, you're going back permanently?
Yes.
How can students who are listening to us today get involved?
They can go to our website, which is studenthurricanenetwork.org. And from there, they can sign up to be on our listserv. We send out pretty much weekly emails with information about what's going on, particular research. I mean, research is something that's needed all around the country. And the other thing is story collection of evacuees in your area, and we'll be having more information about training on that and how people can get hooked up with that. And then if they're interested in going down for spring break, I would encourage them to start thinking about getting together a group at their school. We have what's called institutional liaisons, which is a student kind of at each school that'll kind of serve as the liaison between the network and the school. Start thinking about how they can raise money so students that don't necessarily have money to fly can go. And that type of organizing. It's just around the corner. It's just March, so it's important to start thinking about that stuff.
It's been a pleasure to have you on with us.
Thank you.
And best of luck with your continued work.
This weekend, Riverside Church and Columbia Law School hosted an historic war crimes tribunal. For those of us who were active during Vietnam, we remembered the great war crimes tribunal that took place in Paris, sponsored by Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation.
It was supposed to take place in Paris,
actually, right, yeah.
But the French banned it, and it took place in Stockholm and
Copenhagen.
And Copenhagen.
Yeah,
that's correct.
But in any case, that was a really major event in ending the war in Vietnam, and the truth about American atrocities in Vietnam and its aggressive war came out then. That's what happened this weekend. We're glad to be able to play parts of speeches of the various participants in it.
Including our own Michael Ratner.
And it has a great backdrop. Of course, it's at Riverside Church, which is where in 1967, in April, Martin Luther King gave his great anti-war speech, talking about militarism, poverty, and racism. And then, of course, we'll hear from Harry Belafonte, who also was one of the people speaking at the War Crimes Tribunal.
Let's have a listen.
I have a very special treat for all of us, and that is remarks from somebody who needs no introduction, really, the musician, actor, and social activist that we all know, Harry Belafonte.
I would like to first of all express my great sense of privilege and opportunity to be part of this evening's tribunal and what we will be seeing and hearing. I'd like to also extend my respects to the panel and to the tasks that you have before you and what we will be hearing. It is most fortuitous that this should be taking place at the end of a week of celebration the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This nation has never, ever produced a greater citizen who stood and still stands for the principles for why we are all gathered here. The pursuit of justice, the pursuit of human rights, the pursuit of human dignity. Theodore Roosevelt once said that when the powers of state having been mandated to reach out and to protect the interests of the people, begin to usurp the Constitution and undermine our laws, that it is the responsibility of citizens to rise up and to speak against this process and to, in fact, insist upon the changing of the guard, changing of regime. And those citizens who failed to hear that call should, in fact, be charged with patriotic treason. I think none gathered here this evening can be so charged. It is important that when all of the instruments of governance collapses, that we go in the final hour to the most important line of battle, the people themselves. The people of this nation, I think, and I know, are awake and are being more awakened every day. They're hearing and sensing the danger that sits on the horizon. Tell me, where for you does the line blur? When a nation as powerful as this, the most powerful in the history of human existence, and those who have dubiously come to power and who are reigning over the will of this nation, when they lie and mislead the citizens of this country, when they put before us fear and then govern by terrorism, where does the line blur for you when our sons and daughters are sent to die in foreign battlefields? Each day we claim the lives of tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in other places. Where for you does terrorism end, and where does it begin, and who are the terrorists? Those who would choose to detract the real meaning of this tribunal, the real meaning of this people's moment, would suggest to you that we are somehow, perhaps, irrelevant. Well, I guess Paul Revere was considered at one point irrelevant when he called for the alarm against the Redcoats. I know very well that in the beginning, Dr. Martin Luther King was considered irrelevant. I know that so many who have called to the awakening of our citizens to look at what is happening to us and to seize our rights to put us back into democratic governance. Always in the beginning, we are minimalized, marginalized, and relegated to the dustbins of history. We have prevailed before, and we will prevail again. I am honored to be a part of this process. Anything that I can do to help broaden its base, to broaden its inquiry, and to help save the soul of our nation, I welcome the opportunity, and I will so serve. Thank you.
We have one other important message that we'd like for you to hear, and that is from Michael Ratner. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and was co-counsel in Razul versus Bush, the historic case of Guantanamo detainees, in which the Supreme Court ruled that U.S. courts do indeed have jurisdiction over Guantanamo. Michael is an expert in international human rights law and is a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Michael Ratner.
When Clark called me yesterday and said, "I'll be sharing a platform with Harry Belafonte," I said, "Well, maybe you want to put me on for tomorrow." But here I am. And of course, I'm proud to be even in any kind of association with Harry Belafonte. And I'm sure you're all familiar with Harry Belafonte's comments that he made to President Chavez in Venezuela a few days ago. If you don't remember them, I'll repeat them. No matter what the greatest tyrant in the world, the greatest terrorist in the world, George W. Bush says, "We're here to tell you, not hundreds, not thousands, but millions of the American people support your revolution." Now, what's remarkable about that, of course, Harry Belafonte was heavily attacked for that. But as he has never been willing to do, he did not retreat from the statement. And if you go on the net, you come to what he said. It's at the Children's Defense Fund a few days later. And what he says is, so when I make my remarks, they may stir up controversy, but then it's time to talk about new definitions, new points of view. And that's what Harry Belafonte was doing, and that is what we are doing here today and over the next 2 days at these commissions. The other important point about being here at Riverside, of course, is that in April 1967, this is the place, this church, where Martin Luther King openly and notoriously, I should say, opposed the war in Vietnam. The speech was called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. It's a historic place for that reason, and he began that speech with these words, "A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam." And then in that speech, he lays out a 5-point program, but the ultimate point of the program was remove all foreign troops from Vietnam. Incredibly, even though it was Martin Luther King saying that in 1967, it took 9 more years, millions of Vietnamese deaths, and thousands of American deaths to do so. We today model our conduct on that of Dr. Martin Luther King. As he said then, we say today, a time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to the war in Iraq. It is time to bring the troops home now. And so the question is really, where do we go from here? One place I can tell you not to go is don't go to the Democrats in Washington. I have to tell you, I have never in my life been kicked in the teeth so badly as I was on the Guantanamo cases when we took that to the Democrats in Washington. And I'm just going to say it here. There's a million reasons I can tell you don't go there, but this one is called the Graham-Levin Bill. And after we win the right to go to court for the detainees at Guantanamo, and we win that in the Supreme Court, Republican Senator Graham and Democrat Senator Levin get together, and what do they decide to do a few weeks ago but strip the courts of any jurisdiction to hear the Guantanamo cases? That's what they do, Democrats and Republicans together. And then they say you can use evidence from torture to keep those people in jail, kicking us right in the teeth, kicking the courts in the teeth. And so if you think that we are going to get far by going there, you've got it wrong. Lessons of history teach us that we don't move our leaders without the passion and the protest of the people. I want to close with a sense of hope. It's been a rough 4 years. It's been a rough 20 years. It's been a rough 40 years since Dr. King spoke. But I want to close with a sense of hope. This administration is unraveling. There's a split in the elites. Gore is one of the best examples. Everywhere we see former administration officials speaking out. They realize the administration has gone too far. They want to save some remnant of democracy. We see indictments from Scooter Libby to DeLay coming fast and furious. We see General Miller, responsible for torture in Guantanamo and Iraq, taking the Fifth Amendment, essentially, so he won't have to testify. We see General Sanchez, who is head of troops in Iraq, retiring without that fourth star. It's a real opening for us. But it's not simply to go back to the normal. It's not simply to save a remnant of democracy. The malady is much deeper than that. We need a radical transformation of our society. My hopes for today and for the future is that the truth will arouse resistance. And with resistance, there will be some change. I mean resistance of every sort, mobilizing, protesting, disobeying, and disobedience. And then again, when I was reading Dr. King's speech, the thought that he closed with and that I want to close with is that sometimes we can wait too long to take action. Or as Dr. King said, you can be too late. And we, unless we act, may be too late. So let me end with Dr. King's directive to us all. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. There is such a thing as being too late. We still have a choice today. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. Thank you. We'll do this together.
Thank you, Michael. Based on what we believe to be overwhelming and clear evidence, the Commission of Inquiry has indicted the Bush administration for war crimes and crimes against humanity for its invasion and occupation of Iraq. Tonight we're going to be hearing testimony on the charges in this indictment from some of the world's most knowledgeable experts and eyewitness observers. Mr. Ritter tonight is going to have his testimony taken by Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern worked as a CIA analyst from 1961 to 1990. Mr. McGovern's responsibilities included chairing the national intelligence estimates and preparing briefs for the president's daily brief. I would now like to introduce Mr. Scott Ritter and Mr. Ray McGovern, who will take his testimony. Thank you.
Dick Cheney was lying. Dick Cheney knew he was lying, and this is one of the harshest indictments one can make against a government official of the United States of America. This is a civil crime, not necessarily a war crime. To lie in the conduct of your official duties is a felony, and I believe Dick Cheney and others should be held accountable to this. But it is also evidence that the Bush administration willfully exaggerated the case about the threat posed by Iraqi WMD, thereby negating any case they might make about the existence of a clear and present threat that warranted preemptive attack.
Mr. Ritter, I can just imagine how you reacted to the strange pronouncements coming out from some of our leaders. You also have pointed out that this information, though suppressed in our depressed as well, suppressed in our main media, that there was a report on the Hussein Kamel information in Newsweek a month before the war. How do you account for the fact that it remained in the Periscope section of Newsweek and that neither the Times nor the Post nor anyone else took any note of it? Here, a report from the fellow in charge of the weapons program, missile, biological, chemical, nuclear, he's saying that they'd all been destroyed in 1991. How could it be that our media would have ignored that, Mr. Ritter?
That's a question that only the media can answer. I can say that the information was provided by myself to CNN executives. Indeed, CNN taped a one-hour interview with myself where these documents played a central part. This interview was taped and never aired because of an executive decision made by CNN. CNN can only answer why they chose not to air this information, and I believe the other media outlets are, again, the only ones that can answer that question. It's information that was very relevant. It's information that directly contradicted the statements made by the Bush administration, and it's information that would have undermined severely the case the Bush administration was making regarding Iraq, the threat, and justification for war.
We just heard a few clips from this weekend's War Crimes Tribunal. We hope that this will help mobilize people to keep fighting against the oppressive government regime. We also have posted this on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Have you seen the Iron Lady's charms?
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Stop the murder, deter the crimes away. Only killing shows killing doesn't pay. Yes, that's the kind of law it takes. Even though we make mistakes and sometimes send not a chance to learn. Waiting for someone to call. They serve him one last meal, shave his head. Oh, they ask him how he feels. When the warden comes to say goodbye, reporters come to watch him die. Watch him as he's strapped into the chair. And the chaplain, he reads the final prayer. Be brave, my son, the Lord is waiting there. Oh, murder is so wrong, you see. Both the Bible and the courts agree that the state's allowed to murder in the chair. In the courtroom, watch the balance of the scale. If the price is right, there's time for more appeal. The strings are pulled, the switches fade, the finest lawyer's fees are paid, and a rich man never died upon the chair. Have you seen the iron?